If a food plant is substantially equivalent to its parent plant, it is deemed safe to eat. But when that plant has been re-engineered to contain a pesticide and to withstand an herbicide, we simply must ask, how can a plant killed by insects be equivalent to a plant that kills insects?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,091st edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. And thank you, Will Strickland, for the introduction. Folks, perhaps you're among our friends over there in sunny Lisbon who are tuned in today as we along in the Food Chain page. Welcome you. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, I have a question for you.
Yes.
A plant that kills, that is killed by insects be equivalent to a plant that kills insects?
That's a really loaded question there.
It is.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I honestly don't know.
Honestly don't know. Well, what about our intern producer, Olivia Duncan? Does she know?
I think we need to first define what equivalent means.
Oh, there you go. That's our job for the day. What is substantial equivalence? And that's the folks, you to see a real live, living miracle. Take a summer drive through America's heartland. The miracle you will see is the acre upon acre, mile upon mile of crops growing in laser straight perfection with no bugs, no weeds, very few people. Admittedly, it helps to have been a teenage herbicide to understand the magnificence of no bugs, no weeds, very few people. This miracle was made possible by the reengineering of the crop's genetic codes. Whereas before crops were preyed upon by insects, the crops have now been reengineered to contain a biological pesticide that literally eats away the insect's stomach lining. When an insect takes a bite out of that plant, it literally loses its stomach. Poof, it's dead. Crops also have been re-engineered to withstand herbicides that kill weeds. This re-engineering gives a single farmer the ability to kill all the weeds in the field with an airplane, which is a lot more fun than doing it with a sharp hoe. These re-engineered crops, of course, are what we eat, either directly in our cornflakes or tacos, or indirectly in our bacon and eggs or veggie burgers. The crops have been declared safe to eat by virtue of the fact that they are substantially equivalent to their non-re-engineered parents, which we have been safely eating for millenniums. And so we ask, how can a plant killed by insects be equivalent to a plant that actually kills insects? Here to help us resolve the puzzle, we have a couple of very fun people to talk with today, beginning with Dr. Allison Van Inenem. Allison, have we got the name right there? We've been practicing for days.
You did a really good job, Michael.
Good, thank you very much. It has a lot of vowels.
It does.
Okay. You're a cooperative extension scientist of Animal Genomics and Biotechnology, University of California, Davis, and Aggie. So, a long and distinguished career in biotechnology. I'll bet you really... You know, your career probably has spanned the time from the evolution of when we used to select crops by their attributes and said, now we re-engineer them for their attributes. You really probably were in on the beginning and on that whole thing.
Yeah, I was. So 1996 was the first introduction of a genetically engineered crop, and so that's certainly within my career span. And
mm-hmm.
So I think that's it's been an interesting evolution.
And so tell us about your career. I mean, how did you get involved and where has it taken you?
Well, I'm actually an animal breeder. You can probably tell by my accent I'm originally Australian. And I came over here to be an Aggie to undertake a PhD in genetics. And so I work with cattle breeding, trying to select for animals that are less resistant to disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of tangentially got involved in the GMO debate just because there's just so much confusion around this very politicized breeding method.
It certainly is politicized. It certainly is confusing. We got to grant you that. So, quick question. Do you keep your accent just because it's so effective?
I don't know how the actors do that, but this is how I speak.
Okay, good to go. So your career, we understand you were with Monsanto as well?
Yep, I was in their genomics team for 3 years at Celgene, right when the Flavor Saver tomato, the tomato that didn't go rotten, came onto the market.
And that was really the first GMO product, right?
It was the first GMO plant, and it was interesting. I was in Davis at the time, and it was met with quite a good degree of excitement, and it couldn't keep it on the shelves. Unfortunately, it wasn't a great tasting tomato, so it didn't go rotten, but it didn't really do a very good for a market success there.
Okay.
And I think that's an important kind of example, because that particular application of genetic engineering was nothing to do with insecticides or pesticides in any way. And I really think it's important to understand that this is a breeding method that can get used for many things, like disease-resistant papayas that don't involve the use of any type of pesticide.
Sure. And we noticed that an apple has just been approved for marketing throughout the Midwest, that you can slice it in two and it won't go brown.
Right. Yep, that's the apple that basically has a protein turned off that is the enzyme that makes it go brown when it's exposed to air. And so now you can slice it and it won't go brown in the kids' lunch bag waiting till they get to lunchtime at noon.
So the question then is that there are all kinds of interesting things happening in the future about what it really has transpired in the past, which gives us an opportunity to introduce our next guest, which is McKay Jenkins, who is the author of Food Fight, GMOs in the Future of the American Diet. McKay, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Well, an English professor.
Yeah, English professors have to eat too, after all.
Well, that's what happened to me. I have a degree in English and Chinese literature, which is so useless, I had to go into radio.
Well, you can probably quote the Tao Te Ching on live radio, so that's
There you go. Well, why GMOs? Why did you pick up the subject of GMOs to write about?
Well, in addition, and maybe even more than being an English professor, I'm a journalism professor, and I also started a program in what we call environmental humanities, which is trying to understand environmental questions from many points of view, partly from science, but also partly from history and philosophy and politics and economics and all the other things that go into it. The last book that I wrote before Food Fight was called Contamination, and that was really looking at how petrochemicals have been adopted to be used in virtually every kind of consumer product that we now have, from our drinking water bottles to our lipstick to our plywood in our houses to our carpeting and all that. So I really covered the whole spectrum of consumer products, but I really didn't look much at food, and that was an obvious big hole in this whole exploration. So with all the discussion and politics about genetically engineered food, that became an obvious thing to kind of look at. And the science is fascinating, and as our other guest has said, is something that can be used in all kinds of ways and all kinds of contexts, but there's also an awful lot more going on with these decisions about how we eat, that is, taking the foundation of the science and then applying it to really intimate parts of our lives, like how we decide to eat and how we decide to provide food to our families and to the rest of the world. So there are really quite a lot of interesting questions here.
And that makes it a great subject for the Food Chain radio program, because that's exactly what we do, and we try to do at any rate. Let's go back and start with this doctrine of substantial equivalence, which seems to me where everything started. Dr. Van Eenenman, would you please tell us exactly what it is?
Well, it's kind of a question of, is this food safe? And how do you determine safety? You say, well, is this food as safe as its traditional counterpart? So I've got a new variety of apple, I don't know, Red Delicious. Is that as safe as a Golden Delicious? Well, it depends on how safe the Golden Delicious is. And so you try to establish the safety in the context of traditional counterpart. And if the new product doesn't raise a different question of public health, then it's considered to be substantially equivalent.
Isn't that kind of like what we've been doing forever? I mean, haven't we always gone to mom and said, Mom, I want to eat this? And mom says, no, you can't eat that. Or, yes, you can eat that. Why does mom say that? Well, because she knows that it's been successfully eaten before and we can get away with it, probably. Makes sense, Mr. Jenkins?
It does. I mean, I think that the scientific consensus around the world from all the major scientific bodies says that the use of genetic engineering to create new foods, there is no more danger in eating genetically altered foods than there is in eating traditionally raised foods. I don't think there's really a whole lot of debate about that. I mean, there's some outliers that question that. But really, that, as I write in my book, that's the first thing and sometimes the only thing anybody wants to know. But that's not the only question. It may not even be the most important question.
Good to go. We'll have to pick up the rest of it when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about GMOs. Are they safe to eat? Well, we know they're safe to eat because they are substantially equivalent to their non-GMO parents. Or are they? That's the question on the table today. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it. Metro Farm it.
From the AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am, Jacoby with you with our flagship.
You can dream it, build it, own it. Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it. Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it. Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it. Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it. Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it. Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it. Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it. Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what's eating what is we people have been eating corn for millenniums with no problems, or at least the standard problems, I guess. But then we figured out how to re-engineer corn so that it would essentially kill the insects that attacked it, and we could spray herbicides on it, and it would not kill the plant. Wow, what a miracle. One person can now grow 1,000 acres of corn. No bugs, no pests. That is a miracle, in my way of thinking, having been a teenage herbicide myself and hoed many weeds out in the hot sun of Montana, Yellowstone River Valley. So how did all of this happen? How did we allow this magical new cultivar to be allowed into the food chain without any safety studies? Because if you were to introduce a new drug into the food chain, you would have to subject it to lots of very expensive double-blind studies with lots of people, cost lots of money. But we didn't have to do that with genetically engineered organisms. We allowed them in because we say they are substantially equivalent. So how on earth did we come upon deciding on this substantial equivalency doctrine? Well, I asked our intern producer, Olivia Duncan, how it all came about. Olivia?
Yeah, I according to my research, I understand that Michael Taylor actually played a large role in getting GMOs to avoid safety checks. He was a former Monsanto lawyer, and then he was appointed by the Bush administration to the FDA, which generated a lot of controversy. And I'm wondering, Professor Van Inenem, since you worked with Monsanto, did you also work with Michael Taylor?
Good question.
Wow, we're going full conspiracy theory here. No, I worked in their genomics division over here at Calgene, which is in Davis, because I'm an Aggie and I've always lived in Davis. And I think that the way that was just couched really just ignored the first section, where both McKay and I said that every scientific society in the world has looked at this and said that this technology is not associated with unique safety risks. And in fact, every product that has been commercialized has gone through FDA evaluation for safety. So I think that it's a bit unfair to suggest that there's no safety checks going on.
But that's interesting. I always understood that the FDA doesn't do testing.
Well, that's a myth that gets propagated by groups opposed to this technology, but every product that has been approved, commercialized on the market to date has been through an FDA evaluation. Mm-hmm. And they have had to show that there's no new allergens, no new toxins.
How do they show that?
By examining the composition of the crop, whatever
the crop
is. Does
the FDA do that composition study?
They, as with all products that are getting evaluated, the data is developed by the companies and examined by the FDA.
Oh, that's when it says developer then. So when somebody puts a new GMO out there, they're called a developer.
Well,
they do the
studies.
I mean,
if you look, it's a multi-year process to get an approval, and it goes through multiple generations of evaluation. And I think what's important to understand is that process is quite lengthy, and it costs, I think the average is $136 million. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that very extensive evaluation, it more or less makes this particular breeding method the exclusive purview of large multinational companies. And so the public sector breeders, like at the universities, really have no opportunity to develop what I would argue are really useful genetically engineered crops that might be disease resistant or more flavorful, because there's such an extensive evaluation process. It's more or less had the very result that a lot of people are concerned about, where only large multinational companies can bring products to market.
Mm-hmm. So essentially then, the developer does the studies, hands the studies to the FDA. The FDA looks at the studies and says, this is substantially equivalent or not. That's kind of what I hear.
In terms of the food safety in that regard, they also look, for example, at if there's a protein being expressed, which there may or may not be, depending on what the product is, whether that protein is toxic. So you mentioned the BT protein that's an insect protection.
Mm-hmm.
That is specific for caterpillars that eat that. It's not toxic to humans. It's actually a widely used insecticide in organic production systems. And so you look at the attributes of the expressed protein, and that is something that's considered also in the safety evaluations. Is it an allergen? You know, because there are some proteins that are allergens. So those types of things are looked at based on the product being evaluated. In the case of the papaya, for example, which is a disease-resistant papaya, you know, what are you looking at there is whether the papaya is in fact disease-resistant. Is there any new safety concerns? And that was developed by a public sector breeder. Nothing to do with that one particular company that everybody seems to want to demonize. And I think that's really important, because there's so many useful applications being developed by the public sector, and we have a really hard time getting it to market because of the very expensive and extensive evaluations mm-hmm. that these products have to go through.
Is that the same kind of evaluation that pharmaceuticals go through? For example, I believe the pharmaceutical drug has to go through a double-blind studies in which some people are fed the drug and other people's are not, and everything is measured that way. Is that the same kind?
So we don't do that for food varieties, right? So if I want to bring a new potato or tomato to market, there are risks associated with developing potatoes and tomatoes, because all plants have their own naturally occurring pesticides. In fact, it's estimated 99.99% of our dietary exposure to pesticides is naturally occurring pesticides that exist in plants, mm-hmm. because plants don't want to get eaten. actually have their own internal pesticides to try to prevent insects from eating them.
Do you think my question unfair, that can a plant that is eaten by insects be equivalent to a plant that kills insects? Do you think that's an unfair question?
Well, I think that you have to look at it in the context of existing insecticides that exist in crops. For example, potatoes and tomatoes produce their own insect resistance, mm-hmm. and if you select too hard for insect-resistant tomatoes, you'll actually develop toxic levels of that insecticide in these naturally occurring insecticides in tomatoes. And so it's important to look at the actual, what it is that's the insecticide and what the level of exposure is. In the case of the tomato, that's a naturally occurring protein that is dangerous to humans. In the case of BT, that's a naturally occurring protein that isn't toxic to humans. And so to me, that's a better solution than spraying it with an organophosphate insecticide. side. And if you look, the introduction of insect-protected crops has dramatically reduced insecticide use globally.
Insecticide use, but not herbicide use, right?
Well, now we change to a different use, right? So we were talking about insect protection.
Okay, but hold on for a minute. Hold on. Let me go back to the professor here of English and journalism. Professor, do you think my question unfair? Can we see a substantial equivalence in an insect killed by a plant killed by an insect than a plant that kills insects?
I don't think it's an unfair question. I don't think it's the right question. I think you've just heard a really reasonable scientific response, which is that, it depends on what you're doing with this technology. I don't know if you have time before the break, but I would like to offer a slightly different way of thinking about
it. If you can get it in a minute.
Okay, well, another big thing we should be talking about is what are these crops being used for? Like, it's absolutely true that, like, an antiviral papaya that can survive and actually rehabilitate an entire crop in Hawaii is a very useful technique that uses this technology in one way, as is a drought-resistant gene that might help a farmer in Africa, for example. But in the United States, these GMOs are largely being used to create monoculture crops that are grown on 170 million acres of land, which has environmental consequences. They're also being used largely to make processed food and fast food and soda pop and cheap snack. So it's not just about whether the thing is dangerous, but what kind of food it's being introduced to, which is the bedrock of our American diet.
And the bedrock of the food. It's also the bedrock of the Food Fight book that you have written, correct?
That's right.
So, okay, folks, we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to talk about the war of studies on substantial equivalency of GMOs. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we are back. What do you think, folks? Are those GMO crops that can now kill insects, are they safe for us to eat? Well, there's a lot of people say, yes, of course they're safe to eat. And, of course, now those foods, those corn crops, soybeans and whatnot, in just about everything we eat, unless we're eating an entirely organic food, that's, we're getting those GMOs. Are they safe? Well, some say they are, some say they aren't. And it's quite a war now developing, from what I see, over whether they are substantially equivalent, or whether GMOs are substantially equivalent to their non-GMO parents. Our very own Dr. Van Inenen is one of the principals in this fight, and she's the one who's, are you not? I mean, I see your name. You're the author of a very famous by now meta study on the efficacy, the safety efficacy of GMO foods. And, you're proudly standing up and say, hey, these are safe to eat. But there are others who are saying, well, wait a minute, they're not so safe to eat. Seralini and Antonio are two of them who are coming up and saying that they are not safe to eat. And so we have this war of studies over what's what and what's eating what. And our producer, Olivia Duncan, is scratching her head over there. You're an environmental studies major. You know something about this subject. What do you think? You were scratching your head.
Yeah. As an environmental studies major, I have a little more insight into the politics of how this works. But at the same time, I'm still very, very confused as a consumer. You know, marketing and even learning more of this information just really makes it worse. So what are the public to do? You know, those who are health conscious, what are we supposed to eat?
Well, is there an answer? McKay, let's start with you. You're the author of Food Fight. We're fighting it out here. Who's winning?
Well, I think one thing to do is ask yourself if you even know where GMOs show up in the supermarket. I mean, a lot of people think that because we're talking about plants that they must be in the produce aisle. But the truth is, most places you go, you're not going to find any genetically altered foods in the produce aisle. Where you're going to find them is in the high fructose corn syrup in your soda. You're going to find it in the snack foods. You're going to find it in the cheap hamburgers at fast food restaurants. The GMOs in this country that we're talking about really are, as I said before, 170 million acres of soybeans and corn. Now, we can argue about whether those the genetics are safe or not, and I think we've at least we have said that the unanimous decision of scientists is that they are safe. But that's
well, that's what you're saying. But the other people on the other side are saying, well, wait a minute, not so certain.
Yeah, but if you look at Seralini, I mean, some of these studies are not just talking about GMOs, they're also talking about the herbicides that are used with them, for example, glyphosate. So,
oh,
you know, it's also
now we're really getting to the crux of this issue, are we not? Is there a way to separate the actual GMO from the chemicals that go along with it? I mean, we have a GMO corn, and we look at it, is that safe? But then we infuse that corn with a Bacillus thuringiensis biological pesticide, and we dump all kinds of herbicides on top of it. So it seems like the chemicals that and the biologicals that we are using in conjunction with the GMO may be confusing the issue. Dr. Venninen?
Well, you know, I think you need to look at each different application separately, right? We've talked about the virus-resistant papaya that doesn't use anything. We've spoken about the insect-protected crops, the BT. That BT has been shown to be safe to humans, and it's reduced by 98% the use of insecticides on corn as a result of protecting it, so they don't need to spray organophosphate insecticides, which I would argue is a much safer approach there. If you want to speak specifically about herbicide tolerance, then you need to look at probably the Roundup Ready crops, and we can have a discussion around that. But I think you need to look at, well, what did farmers do to control weeds before the introduction of Roundup
Ready? They used me. Me and my sharp hoe is what farmers use.
You and your sharp hoe, and I also was a teenage herbicide, so I know what you're talking about.
When it gets right down to it, you know, those of us have used the hoe are really fascinated with this magic, you know, that allows farmers to grow crops without that sharp hoe, because it's not fun work.
To be honest, in 1996, before this was introduced, it wasn't that they were using a hoe. They were using more toxic, persistent herbicides that weren't Roundup. Yeah. And so we've actually had a substitution to an herbicide that has less toxicological properties.
Well, let me ask you a study question. You know, one of the key points in all of these studies that are coming out is that the industry judges the safety efficacy of some of these GMOs by doing short-term feeding studies. I mean, that was the key point of the Seralini rat study, that Monsanto tested rats for 90 days, and he said, look, the rats are fine. Seralini tested the rats for their lifespan, and they all had cancerous tumors, and said, see, it's not fine. So how do we come to grips with that, Doctor?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at the weight of evidence. So the Seralini study is a huge outlier that used a strain of rat that is well known to have spontaneous rates of tumor by 2 years of age. And it has been, you know, lambasted by the scientific community globally. And I think if you look at the weight of evidence, the thousands of safety studies that have been done, about half of which have been done by public sector scientists that have nothing to do with the companies, the weight of evidence shows that there's no unique risks. And it's kind of distressing at this stage to still be discussing one study with 120 rats that has been globally
let's move on to your meta study then, your trillion meal study, in which the claim is that to over 100 billion animals consuming a total exceeding 1 trillion meals of genetically modified grain over a 19-year period show no statistical difference in health when compared with livestock in a conventional diet. Fair enough, that's an incredible study. Two objections from the other side. One of them is that you're measuring 95% of the study was talking about chickens, and the study was a broiler chickens that are essentially live a 49-day lifespan out of a 5-year lifespan. So it's a very short life. It's almost like feeding teenagers can live on sawdust and nails and still be healthy. And that's, so, you know, they do, I that. Mean, but when you get older, the troubles start to show up. So when you look at broiler chickens that are only 49 days old, they're bound to be healthy, no matter what you feed them.
So that particular study used the argument that about 90% of GM forage is consumed by livestock. So have there been deleterious trends in their health and productivity? The answer is no. That doesn't stand alone because that's subjective data, right? You don't have a control. But there are literally hundreds of long-term studies. Although Seralini says he's the first, there are other long-term studies that have been done under controlled environments that show no safety difference. And, you know, we started off this segment talking about safety, and I think McKay's point is that this is not the discussion we should be having around this technology. There's other more important aspects.
But as you heard from, you know, our young producer from the University of California, who's an environmental studies, she understands the parameters of the discussion, but still confused as to whether it's safe to eat. And I guess that's still the question we're trying to come to the grips with. On the Food Chain, Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, and we're working with two people who are in the know, Dr. Allison Van Eneman, who is the Cooperative Extension Specialist, Animal Genomics and Biotechnology at University of California, Davis, and McKay Jenkins, author of Food Fight and You, 831-479-1980. We'll go to the phones when we get back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I forgot to ask a very important question. Well, the second question. The first question is, can a plant killed by insects be equivalent to a plant that kills insects? Lots of people say yes. But I got to wondering, what do they measure when they measure equivalency? Dr. Van Eneman, how does that work? What do you know, when you take two apples and you set them on the table, and one has been re-engineered to do other things and than its parent, how do you measure them? What do you look at inside the apple?
Well, basically, you're looking at its composition. So, you know, what proteins and all the rest of it is in there. And I think, you know, I guess to me, a good analogy perhaps is different wines, right? So mm-hmm. We understand that wines taste different, but depending upon where they're growing and what variety of grape it is. But that doesn't mean that they are compositionally different, but they're not dangerous. And really what they're looking for is whether the product raises a different question in terms of public health. So is there a toxin or an allergen in there that would be problematic from a public health standpoint? Or have you dramatically changed the composition of that plant so it's no longer analogous to a typical corn plant? And is it within the biological variation that we see in corn plants, depending upon where they're growing and the environment that they're growing in? That's basically what they're looking at.
If that's the case, do they then measure the fact that this corn now kills insects and can withstand herbicides? I mean, does that somehow factor into the equivalency?
So the equivalency is looking at the composition of the product. So in the case of the insect-protected one, is that BT protein altering the nutrient value of the product? Is the BT protein toxic to humans? Is it an allergen? And all of those answers are no. As I've said, it's used routinely in organic insect protection by spraying it on the plants. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, the decision or the outcome of the data is that there is substantially equivalent because it doesn't raise any new questions of public health, and that really is kind of the bar that is
okay. And these studies by Seralini and Antonio and others then are outliers, and we're in which they say that when you re-engineer corn, you change the composition of 117 proteins and 91 metabolites.
You're talking about a different Seralini study now, but the thing there is where they were looking at corn, one replicate per se, and having a look at all of the metabolites in there using omics, and then just saying, well, this one's different. It's from an N of one versus the control or the comparator. And the question is, well, what is that a public health concern? Because we know that, like, a golden apple, golden delicious is different to a red delicious, or if it's growing on a hill or a different environment or cultivation practices, will change the comp. You know, every meal you've ever eaten has a different composition to every other meal you've ever eaten, but that doesn't mean that it's a public health concern. It doesn't mean it raises new questions in terms of public health.
Fair
and
enough.
That is the substantial equivalence.
We are going to go to the phones right now, and we're going to start with Matt. Matt, welcome aboard.
Thanks. I was listening to the radio last week up north. John Gray, the behavioral author, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, he does a lot of research on diet, and he said that estrogen is the byproduct of this GMO foods, that they fatten up the animals with estrogen, and it's passed on to the humans, and what it does is it raises the estrogen level in males, causing prostate cancer, and it causes them to have a retarded development, puberty-wise, and the opposite effect on the women. They start to be go through puberty at the age of 8.
Well, that should be a question that Dr. Van Nieuwenman should be able to answer, if anybody could. Doctor?
Garbage. You know, show me one piece of data that supports that. You know, these fear-mongering stories just take off. And, you know, we've had demonstrated how important it is to base our discussions around facts and not these alternate things that are just made up. So that is absolutely not true.
Sean, let's ask Sean. Sean, you better have some facts.
Unfortunately, I do not have facts. I'm not near as well studied as the guest that you have. But I do want to kind of raise the question that you're asking. A plant that is exactly the same, but one kills pests and one does not. I have no reasoning to believe that they should be considered the same nor safe. If it kills a pest, how could it be considered safe for a human?
Can I jump in here?
Go ahead, McKay Jenkins.
I think a much better question with much more science behind it is not whether GMOs are causing hormone or endocrine problems in men and women, but this is the what I wrote about in my previous book. There are many, many products that do. For example, your caller probably drinks water out of a plastic water bottle that is made with a chemical known as phthalates, and phthalates are a well-documented hormone disruptor that leaks into the water that you're drinking. Now, there's no disputing that, but that's not a GMO problem. That has nothing to do with genetic engineering. That has to do with the introduction of petrochemicals into all these things that we come into contact
with. It's amazing that we actually live past 3, given all the stuff that we're eating, don't you think?
Well, I think a larger question that we ought to talk about is the state of science in a world of politics, because...
Well, that's an interesting question. I like that question, because that's what I'm puzzling at. I have a whole handful of studies here, and they are absolutely certain that their side is right, and they have the science to prove it, and the other side is crazy. And so how does one go through the politics to find the substance? Where do we look?
Well, I think part of... Go ahead,
McKay.
Well, hold on. We're going to take a break, and we'll pick you both up when we come back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, how on earth do we answer Matt's question? There must be a difference between a plant that is killed by insects and one that kills insects. There must be a difference. It can't be substantially equivalent. Who wants to answer it? McKay, start with you. Dr. Van Nieuwenman, start with you.
Sorry. I mean, I guess I've tried to answer that earlier, just saying that that particular protein is toxic to insects but not toxic to humans, the BT toxin that's used to protect insects. In the same way that chocolate is perfectly safe for humans to eat, but don't give it to your dog. Right? So there's going to be an interaction between what is toxic to one species and not another. And in the case of the BT toxin, it's been shown to be obviously toxic to caterpillars, but to be perfectly safe for humans.
Okay, then McKay will get the next question from Mary.
Thank you, Michael. I have a question regarding the U.S. policies on patents, wherein the patent holder holds 100% of the control of research. In other words, if I were to come and ask to research, the damage on chickens with GMO crops that feed them, I would be told how I could do it, when I could do it, and the duration of it. I could not go outside the scope of that, or I would be sued.
Okay, let's go to McKay for that. Thank you, Mary.
Well, I think now we're starting to open the aperture up a little bit to talk about the way that this technology is being actually used in an industrial food system. It really, as we keep trying to say, is way beyond just simply whether or not they're safe or not. And when you think about the way that corporations control our food supply, regardless of what you think about safety, there are concerns of all kinds when you have an ever-decreasing number of companies controlling an ever-larger proportion of our diet. Legally and in terms of the volume and in terms of the domestic food supply, now increasingly in the global food supply, these questions are really much larger than the safety of the technology, and I wish we'd spend some more
time. We had like another 12 hours to talk about this. Right. Rory, what do you think?
I know there's studies out there that have shown that metabolites of glyphosate are in cord blood of pregnant women, and which means it's getting into the food supply. My major concern about the genetically modified organisms is that the use of glyphosate on this massive scale is, to me, very sloppy, and it is finding its way into the food supply. And that being said, what's going on with Dr. Don Huber's studies? I understand they were doing some pig studies in Japan with the GMO versus non-GMO corn.
Well, previous...
what your experts can tell us.
Dr. Van Nieneman, do you know anything about Dr. Don's studies?
Yes, I've seen that. I always feel like whack-a-mole with this particular topic because these outlier studies get brought up. And I think the other guest, McKay and myself, have been trying to say that if you look at the weight of evidence and the scientific opinion of every single scientific authority in the world, it is there are no unique safety concerns.
So is it your sense then that people like Sarah Leaney and Dr. Don Huber, the professor emeritus of soil science at Purdue University, or wacko?
They're not wacko. I think that they are outside the mainstream science. They never refer back to the weight of evidence, and they have a very politicized agenda. And I think that the way to get through that, to your question earlier, is have a look at what are called meta-analyses.
I have to close the program out of time, but I want to thank Dr. Allison Van Eneman, University of California, Davis, McKay Jenkins, author of Food Fight. Thank all of you for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.